home and burn the stuff. Hell, why burn it? What had I done? I even warned the little bugger they'd hang him. They had nothing on me. He was clawing at me, importunately and feebly, saying, "Tell me. You better tell me now." It would be too easy. It was perfect. And the perfect mathematical irony of it, the perfect duplication of what Duffy had done, struck me, and I felt like laughing out loud. "Listen here," I said to Sugar Boy, "stop clawing me, and listen here, and I'll..." He stopped clawing and stood meekly before me. He would do it. I knew he would do it, and it was such a joke on Duffy I almost laughed out loud. And as the name of Duffy flashed across my mind, I saw Duffy's face, large and lunar and sebaceous, nodding at me as at the covert and brotherly appreciation of a joke, and even as I opened my lips to speak the syllables of his name, he winked. He winked right at me like a brother. I stood there stock still. Sugar Boy's face began to twitch again. He was going to ask again. I stared down at him. "I was kidding," I said. There was absolute blankness on his face, and then an absolute murderousness. There wasn't any flare of fury. It was a cold and innocent and murderous certainty. It was as though his face had suddenly frozen in a split second in that certainty, and it looked like the face of a man who had been trapped and had died in the snow long ago, centuries ago, back in the Ice Age, perhaps, and the glacier brings it down all those centuries, inch by inch, and suddenly, with its primitive purity and lethal innocence, it stares at you through the last preserving glaze of ice. I stood there for what seemed forever. I couldn't move. I was sure I was a goner. Then the ice face wasn't there. It was just Sugar Boy's face on a head too big for the neck, and it was saying, I darn near done it. I ran my tongue over my dry lips. "I know it," I said.
You oughtn't done me that way,"
he said in humble complaint. "I'm sorry."
You know how I feel, and you oughtn't done me like that."
"I know how you feel," I said, "and I'm sorry. I really am."
Forget it, he said.
He stood there, seeming smaller than before, slumped and forlorn as though he were a doll that had lost some of its sawdust. I studied him. Then I said as much to myself as to him, I suppose, "You really would have done it."
It was the boss.
He said. "Even if they'd hang you?"
There wasn't nobody like the boss, and they killed him. They had to go and kill him.
He shuffled his feet on the cement floor and looked down at them.
"He could talk so good,"
he half mumbled with his stuttering.
The boss could. Couldn't nobody talk like him. When he made a speech and everybody yelled, it looked like something was going to burst inside you."
He touched his chest with his hand to indicate where something looked like it might bust inside you. Then he looked questioningly at me. "Sure," I agreed, "he was a great talker." We stood there for a half minute more without anything to say to each other. He looked at me and then down at his feet, then back at me and said,
Well, I reckon I'll be getting on.
He put out one of his hands to me and I took it and gave it a shake. "Well, good luck," I said. And he went up the stairs, bending his knees excessively for the stairs, for his legs were stumpy. When he used to drive the big black Cadillac, he always had a couple of flat cushions, the kind you take with you on picnics or in a canoe, to prop behind him so he could properly work the clutch and brake pedals. So that was the last I saw of Sugar Boy. He had been born over in Irish town. He'd been the runt the big boys shoved around in the vacant lot. They'd played baseball, but he hadn't been good enough to play. "Hey, Sawed-Off," they'd say, "go get me that bat," or, "Hey, Sawed-Off, go get me a Coke." And he'd gone to get the bat or the Coke. Or they'd say, "Aw, dry up, Mushmouth, write me a letter." And he'd dried up. But somehow, sometime, he had learned what he could do. Those stubby arms could flip the steering wheel of a car as clean as a bee Martin whips round the corner of a barn. Those pale blue eyes, which didn't have any depth, could look down the barrel of a .38 and see, really see, for one frozen and apocalyptic instant, what was over yonder. So he had found himself one day in the big black Cadillac with a couple of tons of expensive machinery pulsing under his fingers, and the blue steel .38 riding in the dark under his left armpit like a tumor. And the boss was by his side who could talk so good. "Well, good luck," I had said to him, but I knew what his luck would be. Some morning I would pick up the paper and see that a certain Robert, or was it Roger, O'Sheehan had been killed in an automobile crash, or had been shot to death by unidentified assailants while he sat in a car in the shadow outside the Love Me and Leave Me roadhouse and gambling hell operated by his employer, or had that morning walked unassisted to the scaffold as a result of having been quicker on the draw than a policeman named, no doubt, Murphy. Or perhaps that was romantic. Perhaps he would live forever and outlive everything, and his nerve would go, liquor, dope, or just plain time, and he would sit, morning after morning, while the gray winter rain sluiced down the high windows, in the newspaper room of the public library, a scrawny, bald little old man in greasy, tattered clothes bent over a picture magazine. So perhaps I hadn't done Sugar Boy any favor after all, in not telling him about Duffy and the boss and allowing him to whang straight to his mark and be finished like a bullet when it strikes in. Perhaps I had robbed Sugar Boy of the one thing which he had earned out of the years he had lived and which was truly himself, and everything else to come after, no matter what it was, would be waste and accident and the sour and stinking curdle of truth, like what you find in the half-full bottle of milk you had left in the icebox when you went away for your 6-week vacation. Or perhaps Sugar Boy had had something of which he could never be robbed. I stood there in the hall after Sugar Boy had gone, breathing the odor of old papers and disinfectant, and turning these thoughts over in my mind. Then I went back into the newspaper room and sat down and bent over a picture magazine. It was February when I saw Sugar Boy in the library. I continued with the way of life which I had adopted, still hugging the aimlessness and the anonymity about me like a blanket. But there was a difference now, in my own mind if not in the circumstances of my life. And in the end, months later, in May, in fact, the difference which my meeting with Sugar Boy had made in my mind sent me to see Lucy Stark. Now, at least, I can see that such was the case. I telephoned her out at the farm where she was still staying. She sounded all right on the phone, and she asked me to come out. So I was back in the parlor in the little white house, among the black walnut furniture upholstered in red plush, looking down at the flowers in the carpet. Nothing had changed in that room for a long time, or would change for a long time. But Lucy had changed a little. She was fleshier now, with a more positive gray in her hair. She was more like the woman the house had reminded me of the first time I had seen it, a respectable, middle-aged woman in a clean gray gingham dress with white stockings and black kid shoes, sitting in her rocker on the porch with her hands folded across her stomach to take a little ease now the day's work is done and the men folks are still in the field and it's not yet time to think about supper or strain the evening milk. She wasn't that woman yet, but give her 6 or 7 more years and she would be. I sat there with my eyes on a flower in the carpet, or I looked up at her and then again at the flower, and her own glance strayed about the room in that abstracted way a good housewife has of looking around to surprise a speck of dust in the act. We were saying things to each other all the while, but they were strained and difficult things, completely empty. You meet somebody at the seashore on a vacation and have a wonderful time together, Or in a corner at a party, while the glasses clink and somebody beats on a piano, you talk with a stranger whose mind seems to whet and sharpen your own, and with whom a wonderful new vista of ideas is spied. Or you share some intense or painful experience with somebody and discover a deep communion. Then, afterward, you're sure that when you meet again, the gay companion will give you the old gaiety. The brilliant stranger will stir your mind from its torpor. The sympathetic friend will solace you with the old communion of spirit. But something happens, or almost always happens, to the gaiety, the brilliance, the communion. You remember the individual words from the old language you spoke together, but you've forgotten the grammar. You remember the steps of the dance, but the music isn't playing anymore. So there you are. So there we sat for a while, and the minutes sifted and wavered down around us one by one like leaves dropping in still autumn air. Then, after a space of silence, she excused herself, and I was left alone to watch the leaves drift down. But she came back, carrying now a tray on which was a pitcher of iced tea, two glasses with sprigs of mint stuck in them, and a large devil's food cake. That's what they give you in the country in a little white house like that when you make a visit. Iced tea and devil's food cake. She'd made the cake that morning, no doubt, in preparation for my visit. Well, eating the cake would be something to do. Nobody expects you to talk with your mouth full of cake. In the end, however, she said something, perhaps having the cake on the table beside her, seeing somebody eat her cake, which she knew was a good cake, as people had sat on Sunday afternoons and eaten cake in that room for years, made it possible for her to say something. She said, "You knew Tom was dead." She said it perfectly, matter-of-factly, and that was a comfort. "Yes," I replied, "I knew it." I had seen it in the paper back in February. I hadn't gone to the funeral. I figured I'd been to enough funerals, and I hadn't written her a letter. I couldn't very well write a letter and say I was sorry, and I couldn't very well write her a letter of congratulations. "It was pneumonia," she said. I remembered Adam saying that that was what often got such cases. "He died very quickly," she continued, "just 3 days." "Yes," I said. She was silent for a moment, then said, "I am resigned now. I'm resigned to it all now, Jack. A time comes when you think you cannot bear another thing, but it happens to you, and you can bear it. I'm resigned now, by God's help." I didn't make any answer. "Then, after I was resigned, God gave me something so I could live." I murmured something inarticulate. She rose abruptly from her chair, and thinking I was being dismissed, I rose too, clumsily, and started to say something by way of a goodbye. I was ready and anxious to go. I'd been a fool to come, but she reached to touch my sleeve and said, "I want to show you something." She moved away toward the door. "Come with me," she said. I followed her into the little hall, down it, and into a back room. She went across the room briskly. I didn't take it in at first, but there by the window was a crib, and in the crib was a baby. She was standing on the far side of the crib, looking across at me at the instant when I really saw what was there. I guess my face was a study. Anyway, she said, "It's Tom's baby. It's my little grandbaby. It's Tom's baby." She leaned over the crib, touching the baby here and there the way women do. Then she picked it up, holding it up with one hand behind its head to prop the head. She joggled it slightly and looked directly in its face. The baby's mouth opened in a yawn and its eyes squinched and unsquinched, and then, with the joggling and clucking it was getting, it gave a moist and pink and toothless smile, like an advertisement. Lucy Stark's face had exactly the kind of expression on it which you would expect, and that expression said everything there was to say on the subject in hand. She came around the crib, holding the baby up for my inspection. "It's a pretty baby," I said, and put out a forefinger for the baby to clutch, the way you're supposed to do. "It looks like Tom," she said. "Don't you think so?" Then, before I could get an answer ready that wouldn't be too horrendous a lie, she went on, But that's silly to ask you. You wouldn't know. I mean, he looks like Tom when he was a baby. She paused to inspect the baby again. It looks like Tom, she said, more to herself than to me. Then she looked directly at me. I know it's Tom's, she declared fiercely to me. It's got to be Tom's. It looks like him. I looked critically at the baby and nodded. It favors him, all right, I agreed. To think, she said, there was a time I prayed to God it wasn't Tom's baby, so an injustice wouldn't be Tom's. The baby bounced a little in her arms. It was a husky, good-looking baby, all right. She gave the baby an encouraging jiggle and then looked back at me. And now, she continued, I have prayed to God that it is Tom's, and I know now. I nodded. I knew in my heart, she said, and then, do you think that poor girl, the mother, would have given it to me if she hadn't known it was Tom's? No matter what that girl did, even what they said, don't you think a mother would know? She would just know. Yes, I said. But I knew, too, in my heart. So I wrote her a letter. I went to see her. I saw the baby. Oh, I knew even more then. As soon as I saw him and held him, I persuaded her to let me adopt him.
You've got it fixed for a legal adoption? I asked. So she won't... I stopped before I could say, be bleeding you for years.
Oh, yes, she said, apparently not reading my mind. I got a lawyer to go see her and fix everything. I gave her some money, too. The poor girl wanted to go to California and get away. Willie didn't leave much money. He spent almost everything he made. But I gave her what I could. I gave her $6,000.
So Sybil had made a good thing of it after all, I reflected.
Don't you want to hold him?
Lucy asked me in an access of generosity, thrusting out the expensive baby in my direction. Sure, I said, and took him. I hefted him while I carefully tried to keep him from falling apart. How much does he weigh? I asked, and suddenly realized that I had the tone of a man about to buy something.
15 pounds and 3 ounces, she answered promptly, and added, that's very good for 3 months.
Sure, I said, that's a lot.
She relieved me of the baby, gave him a sort of quick snuggle to her bosom, bending her head down so her face was against the baby's head, and then replaced him in the crib.
What's his name? I asked.
She straightened up and came around to my side of the crib. At first, she said, I thought I'd name him for Tom. I thought that for quite a while. Then it came to me. I would name him for Willie. His name is Willie, Willie Stark.
She led the way out into the little hall again. We walked up toward the table where my hat lay. Then she turned around and scrutinized my face as though the light weren't very good in the hall.
You know, she said, I named him for Willie because...
She was still scrutinizing my face.
Because, she continued, because Willie was a great man.
I nodded, I suppose.
Oh, I know he made mistakes,
she said, and lifted up her chin as though facing something.
Bad mistakes. Maybe he did bad things, like they say, but inside, in here, deep down,
and she laid her hand to her bosom,
he was a great man.
She wasn't bothering with my face anymore, with trying to read it. For the moment, she wasn't bothering with me. I might as well not have been there.
He was a great man,
she affirmed again in a voice nearly a whisper. Then she looked again at me calmly.
You see, Jack, she said, I have to believe that.
Yes, Lucy, you have to believe that. You have to believe that to live. I know that you must believe that, and I wouldn't have you believe otherwise. It must be that way, and I understand the fact. For you see, Lucy, I must believe that, too. I must believe that Willie Stark was a great man. What happened to his greatness is not the question. Perhaps he spilled it on the ground the way you spill a liquid when the bottle breaks. Perhaps he piled up his greatness and burnt it in one great blaze in the dark like a bonfire, and then there wasn't anything but dark and the embers winking. Perhaps he couldn't tell his greatness from ungreatness, and so mixed them together that what was adulterated was lost. But he had it. I must believe that. Because I came to believe that, I came back to Burden's Landing. I did not come to believe it at the moment when I watched Sugar Boy mount the stairs from the basement hall of the public library, or when Lucy Stark stood before me in the hall of the little paint-peeling White House in the country. But because of those things, and of all the other things which had happened, I came, in the end, to believe that, and believing that Willie Stark was a great man, I could think better of all other people, and of myself, at the same time that I could more surely condemn myself. I came back to Burden's Landing in early summer at the request of my mother. She telephoned me one night and said, "Son, I want you to come here as soon as you can. Can you come tomorrow?" When I asked her what she wanted, for I still didn't want to go back, she refused to answer me directly. She said she'd tell me when I came. So I went. She was waiting for me on the gallery when I drove up late the next afternoon. We went around to the screen side gallery and had a drink. She wasn't talking much, and I didn't rush her. When, by near 7 o'clock, the young executive hadn't turned up, I asked her was he coming to dinner. She shook her head. "Where is he?" I asked. She turned her empty glass in her hand, lightly clinking the ice left there. Then she said, "I don't know." "On a trip?" I asked. "Yes," she answered, clinking the ice. Then she turned to me. "He's been gone 5 days," she said. "He won't come back until I've gone. You see," she set the glass down on the table beside her with an air of finality, "I'm leaving him." "Well," I breathed, "I'm damned." She continued to look at me as though expecting something, what I didn't know. "Well, I'm damned," I said, still fumbling with the fact which she had presented to me. "Are you surprised?" she asked me, leaning a little toward me in her chair. "Sure I'm surprised." She examined me intently, and I could detect a curious shifting and shading of feelings on her face, too evanescent and ambiguous for definition. "Sure I'm surprised," I repeated. "Oh," she said, and sank back in her chair, sinking back like somebody who has fallen into deep water and clutches for a rope and seizes it and hangs on a moment and loses the grip and tries again and doesn't make it and knows it's no use to try again. There wasn't anything ambiguous now about her face. It was like what I said. She had missed her grip. She turned her face away from me, out toward the bay, as though she didn't want me to see what was on it. Then she said, I thought maybe you wouldn't be surprised. I couldn't tell her why I or anybody else would be surprised. I couldn't tell her that when a woman as old as she was getting to be had her hooks in a man not much more than 40 years old and not windbroke, it was surprising if she didn't hang on. Even if the woman had money and the man was as big a horse's ass as the young executive. I couldn't tell her that, and so I didn't say anything. She kept on looking out to the bay. I thought, she said, hesitated, and resumed, maybe you'd understand why, Jack. Well, I don't, I replied. She held off a while, then began again. It happened last year. I knew when it happened. Oh, I knew it would be like this. When what happened? When you... Then she stopped and corrected what she'd been about to say. When Monty died. Then she swung back toward me, and on her face was a kind of wild appeal. She was making another grab for that rope. Oh, Jack, she said. Jack, it was Monty, don't you see? It was Monty. I reckoned that I saw, and I said so. I remembered the silvery, pure scream which had jerked me out into the hall that afternoon of Judge Irwin's death, and the face of my mother as she lay on the bed later with the knowledge sinking into her.
"It was Monty," she was saying. "It was always Monty. I didn't really know it. There hadn't been anything between us for a long time. But it was always Monty. I knew it when he was dead. I didn't want to know it, but I knew it, and I couldn't go on. There came a time I couldn't go on. I couldn't."
She rose abruptly from her chair like something jerked up by a string.
"I couldn't," she said, "because everything was a mess. Everything had always been a mess."
Her hands twisted and tore the handkerchief she held before her at the level of her waist.
"Oh, Jack," she cried out, "it had always been a mess."
She flung down the shredded handkerchief and ran off the gallery. I heard the sound of her heels on the floor inside, but it wasn't the old bright spirited tattoo. It was a kind of desperate, slovenly clatter, suddenly muted on the rug. I waited on the gallery for a while. Then I went back to the kitchen. "My mother isn't feeling very well," I told the cook. "You or Joe Bell might go up a little later and see if she'll take some broth and egg or something like that." Then I went back into the dining room and sat down in the candlelight, and they brought me the food, and I ate some of it. After dinner, Joe Bell came to tell me that she'd carried a tray up to my mother's room, but she wouldn't take it. She hadn't even opened the door at the knock. She'd just called to say she didn't want anything. I sat on the gallery a long time while the sounds died out back in the kitchen. Then the light went out back there. The rectangle of green in the middle of blackness where the light of the window fell on the grass was suddenly black, too. After a while, I went upstairs and stood outside the door of my mother's room. Once or twice I almost knocked to go in, but I decided that even if I went in, there wouldn't be anything to say. There isn't ever anything to say to somebody who's found out the truth about himself, whether it's good or bad. So I went back down and stood in the garden among the black magnolia trees and the myrtles, and thought how by killing my father I had saved my mother's soul. Then I thought how maybe I had saved my father's soul, too. Both of them had found out what they needed to know to be saved. Then I thought how all knowledge that is worth anything is maybe paid for by blood. Maybe that's the only way you can tell that a certain piece of knowledge is worth anything. It has cost some blood. My mother left the next day. She was going to Reno. I drove her down to the station and arranged all her nice, slick, matched bags and valises and cases and hat boxes in a nice row on the cement of the platform to wait for the train. The day was hot and bright, and the cement was hot and gritty under our feet as we stood there in that vacuity which belongs to the period just before parting at a railway station. We stood there quite a while, looking up the track for the first smudge of smoke on the heat-tingling horizon beyond the tide flats and the clumps of pines. Then my mother suddenly said, "Jack, I want to tell you something."
"Yes?"
"I'm letting Theodore have the house."
That took me so by surprise I couldn't say anything. I thought of all the years she'd been cramming the place with furniture and silver and glass till it was a museum, and she was God's gift to the antique dealers of New Orleans, New York, and London. I was surprised anything could pry her loose from it.
"You see,"
she said, hurrying on in the tone of explanation, misreading my silence,
"it isn't really Theodore's fault, and you know how crazy he is about the place and about living on the row and all that, and I didn't think you'd want it. You see, I thought you had Monty's place, and if you ever lived at the Landing, you'd prefer that because
he was my father," I finished for her, a little grimly.
"Yes," she said simply, "because he was your father. So I decided to..."
"Damn it," I burst out. "It's your house, and you can do whatever you want with it. I wouldn't have it. As soon as I get my bag out of there this afternoon, I'll never set foot in it again, and that's a fact. I don't want it, and I don't care what you do with it or with your money. I don't want that either. I've always told you that."
"There won't be any too much money to worry about," she said. You know what the last 6 or 7 years have been like.
You aren't broke, I asked. Look here, if you're broke,
I'm not broke, she said. I'll have enough to get on with, if I go somewhere quiet and am careful. At first I thought I might go to Europe, then I...
You better stay out of Europe, I said. All hell is going to break loose over there, and not long either.
Oh, I'm not going. I'm going to some quiet, cheap place. I don't know where. I'll have to think.
Well, I said, don't worry about me and the house. You can be plenty sure I'll never set foot in it again. She looked up the tracks east, where there wasn't any smoke yet beyond the pines and the tidelands. She mused for a couple of minutes on the emptiness off there, then said, as though just picking up my own words,
I ought never set foot in it. I married and I came to it, and he was a good man, but I ought to have stayed where I was. I ought never come.
I couldn't very well argue that point with her one way or the other, and so I kept quiet. But as she stood there in the silence, she seemed to be arguing it with herself, for suddenly she lifted up her head and looked straight at me and said,
Well, I did it, and now I know.
And she squared her trim shoulders under her trim blue linen suit and held her face up in the old way like it was a damned expensive present she was making to the world and the world had better appreciate it. Well, she knew now. As she stood there on the hot cement in the dazzle, she seemed to be musing on what she knew. But it was on what she didn't know. For after a while, she turned to me and said,
Son, tell me something.
What?
It's something I've got to know, son.
What is it?
When it happened, when you went to see Monty.
That was it. I knew that was it. And in the midst of the dazzle and the heat shimmering off the cement, I was cold as ice and my nerves crawled cold inside me.
Did he? Was there?
She was looking away from me. You mean, I said, had he got into a jam and had to shoot himself? Is that it? She nodded, then looked straight at me and waited for what was coming. I looked into her face and studied it. The light wasn't any too kind to it. Light would never be kind to it again. But she held it up and looked straight at me and waited. No, I said, he wasn't in any jam. We had a little argument about politics, nothing serious. But he talked about his health, about feeling bad, that was it. He said goodbye to me. I can see now he meant it as the real thing. That was all. She sagged a little. She didn't have to brace up so stiff any longer.
Is that the truth?
She demanded. Yes, I said, I swear to God it is.
Oh,
she said softly and let her breath escape in an almost soundless sigh. So we waited again. There wasn't anything else to say. She had finally, at the last minute, asked what she'd been wanting to ask and had been afraid to ask all the time. Then, after a while, there was the smoke on the horizon. Then we could see, far off, the black smoke moving toward us along the edge of the bright water. Then, with the great grinding and trampling and hissing and the wreaths of steam, the engine had pulled past us to a stop. A white-coated porter began to gather up the nice matched bags and boxes. My mother turned to me and took me by the arm.
Goodbye, son, she said.
Goodbye, I said. She stepped toward me and I put my arm around her.
Write to me, son, she said. Write to me. You're all I've got.
I nodded. Let me know how you make out, I said.
Yes, she said. Yes.
Then I kissed her goodbye, and as I did so, I saw the conductor, who was beyond her, look at his watch and flick it into his pocket with that contemptuous motion a conductor on a crack train has when he's getting ready to wind up the 90-second stop at a hick town. I knew he was that very instant going to call, all aboard, but it seemed a long time coming. It was like looking at a man across a wide valley, and seeing the puff of smoke from his gun and then waiting God knows how long for the tiny report,
or like seeing the lightning way off and waiting for the thunder. I stood there with my arm around my mother's shoulder and her cheek against mine. Her cheek was wet, I discovered, and waited for the conductor to call all aboard. Then it came, and she stepped back from me and mounted the steps and turned to wave as the train drew away and the porter slammed the vestibule door. I looked after the dwindling train that was carrying my mother away until it was nothing but the smudge of smoke to the west and thought how I had lied to her. Well, I had given that lie to her as a going-away present, or a kind of wedding present, I thought. Then I thought how maybe I'd lied just to cover up myself. "Damn it," I said out loud, savagely. "It wasn't for me, it wasn't." And that was true. It was really true. I had given my mother a present, which was a lie. But in return, she'd given me a present, too, which was a truth. She gave me a new picture of herself, and that meant, in the end, a new picture of the world. Or rather, that new picture of herself filled in the blank space which was perhaps the center of the new picture of the world which had been given to me by many people, by Sadie Burke, Lucy Stark, Willie Stark, Sugar Boy, Adam Stanton. And that meant that my mother gave me back the past. I could now accept the past which I had before felt was tainted and horrible. I could accept the past now because I could accept her, and be at peace with her and with myself. For years I had condemned her as a woman without heart, who loved merely power over men and the momentary satisfaction to vanity or flesh which they could give her, who lived in a strange, loveless oscillation between calculation and instinct. And my mother, realizing a condemnation of her, but without perhaps realizing its nature, had done everything she could to hold me and to throttle the condemnation. What she could do to me was to use the force which she was able to use on other men. I resisted and resented this, but I wanted to be loved by her, and at the same time I was drawn by the force, for she was a vital and beautiful woman by whom I was drawn and by whom I was repelled, whom I condemned and of whom I was proud. But the change came. The first hint was in the wild, silvery scream which filled the house when the word of Judge Irwin's death was received. That scream rang in my ears for many months, but it had faded away, lost in the past and the corruption of the past, by the time she called me back to Burden's Landing to tell me that she was going to go away. Then I knew that she was telling the truth, and I felt at peace with her and with myself. I didn't say why to myself at the moment when she told me, or even the next day when we stood on the cement platform and waited for the train, or even when I stood there alone and watched the last smudge of smoke fade to the west. Nor did I say why to myself when I sat alone that night in the house which had been Judge Irwin's house, but which was now mine. I had closed up my mother's house that afternoon, had put the key under the mat on the gallery, and had left it for good. Judge Irwin's house had the odor of dust and disuse and close air. In the afternoon, I opened all the windows and left them open while I went down to the landing for some supper. When I got back and turned the lights on, it seemed more like the house which I remembered from all the years. But sitting there in the study, with the damp, sweet, heavy night air coming in through the windows, I didn't say to myself why I now felt so fully at peace with myself. I thought of my mother, and I felt the peace and the relief and the new sense of the world. After a while, I got up and walked out of the house and down the row. It was a very calm, clear night, with scarcely a sibilance from the water on the shingle of the beach, and the bay was bright under the stars. I walked down the row until I came to the Stanton house. There was a light on in the little back sitting room, a dim light as though from a reading lamp. I looked at the house for a couple of minutes and then entered the gate and walked up the path. The screen door of the gallery was latched, but the main door of the hall inside the gallery was open, and looking across the gallery I could see down the hall, to the place where a rectangle of light was laid on the floor from the open door of the back sitting room. I knocked on the frame of the kitchen door and waited. In a moment Anne Stanton appeared in the patch of light down the hall. "Who is it?" she called. "It's me," I called back. She came down the hall and across the gallery toward me. Then she was at the door, a thin, white-clad figure in the dimness beyond the screen. I started to say hello, but didn't. And she didn't speak either as she fumbled with the latch. Then the door was open and I stepped inside. As I stood there, I caught the trace of the scent she used, and a cold hand compressed my heart. "I didn't know you'd let me in," I said, trying to make it sound like a joke, and trying to see her face in the shadow. I could only see the paleness in shadow and the gleam of her eyes. "Of course I'd let you in," she said. "Well, I didn't know," I said, and gave a kind of laugh. "Why?" "Oh, the way I've behaved." We moved over to the swing on the gallery and sat down. The chains creaked, but we sat so still that the thing didn't sway a hair's breadth. "What have you done?" she asked. I fished for a cigarette, found one, and lighted it. I flicked the match out without looking at her face. "What have I done?" I repeated. "Well, it's what I didn't do. I didn't answer your letter." "That's all right," she said, then added reflectively as though to herself, "That was a long time ago." "It was a long time back, 6 months, 7 months, but I did worse than not answering it," I said. "I didn't even read it. I just set it up on my bureau and never even opened it." She didn't say anything to that. I took a few drags on the cigarette and waited, but there wasn't a word. "It came at the wrong time," I said finally. "It came at a time when everything and everybody, even Ann Stanton, looked just alike to me, and I didn't give a damn. You know what I mean?"
"Yes," she said.
"Like hell you do," I said.
"Maybe I do,"
she said quietly. "Not the way I mean. You couldn't."
"Maybe."
"Well, anyway, that was the way it was. Everything and everybody looked alike. I didn't even feel sorry for anybody. I didn't even feel sorry for myself."
"I never asked you to feel sorry for me," she said fiercely, "in the letter or anywhere else."
"No," I said slowly, "I don't reckon you did."
"I never asked you that."
"I know," I said, and fell silent for a moment, then said, "I came up here to tell you I don't feel that way anymore. I had to tell somebody, I had to say it out loud, to be sure it's true. But it's true." I waited in the silence, which remained unbroken until I began again. "It's my mother," I said. "You know," I said, "how it always was with us, how we didn't get along, how I thought that she..."
"Don't!"
Anne burst out.
"Don't. I don't want to hear you talk that way. What makes you so bitter? What do you talk that way for? Your mother, Jack, and that poor old man, your father."
"He's not my father," I said.
"Not your father?"
"No," I said, and sitting there in the motionless swing on the dark gallery, I told her what there was to tell about the pale-haired and famished-cheeked girl who had come down from Arkansas, and tried to tell her what my mother had finally given back to me. I tried to tell her how if you could not accept the past and its burden, there was no future, for without one there cannot be the other, and how if you could accept the past, you might hope for the future, for only out of the past can you make the future. I tried to tell her that. Then, after a long silence, she said,
"I believe that, for if I had not come to believe it, I could not have lived."
We didn't talk any more. I smoked another half a pack of cigarettes, sitting there in the swing in the dark with the summer air heavy and damp and almost 6 feet around us, and trying to catch the sound of her breath in the silence. Then, after a long time, I said good night and went down the road to my father's house. This has been the story of Willie Stark, but it's my story, too. For I have a story. It's the story of a man who lived in the world, and to him the world looked one way for a long time, and then it looked another and very different way. The change didn't happen all at once. Many things happened, and that man did not know when he had any responsibility for them and when he did not. There was, in fact, a time when he came to believe that nobody had any responsibility for anything, and there was no God but the great Twitch. At first that thought was horrible to him when it was forced on him by what seemed the accident of circumstance, for it seemed to rob him of a memory by which unconsciously he had lived. But then a little later it gave him a sort of satisfaction, because it meant that he couldn't be called guilty of anything, not even of having squandered happiness, or of having killed his father, or of having delivered his two friends into each other's hands and death. But later, much later, he woke up one morning to discover that he didn't believe in the Great Twitch anymore. He didn't believe in it because he had seen too many people live and die. He had seen Lucy Stark and Sugar Boy and the Scholarly Attorney and Sadie Burke and Ann Stanton live, and the ways of their living had nothing to do with the Great Twitch. He had seen his father die. He had seen his friend Adam Stanton die. He had seen his friend Willie Stark die and had heard him say with his last breath, "It might have been all different, Jack. You got to believe that." He had seen his two friends, Willie Stark and Adam Stanton, live and die. Each had killed the other. Each had been the doom of the other. As a student of history, Jack Burden could see that Adam Stanton, whom he came to call the man of idea, and Willie Stark, whom he came to call the man of fact, were doomed to destroy each other, just as each was doomed to try to use the other and to yearn toward and try to become the other, because each was incomplete with the terrible division of their age. But at the same time Jack Burden came to see that his friends had been doomed, he saw that though doomed, they had nothing to do with any doom under the godhead of the Great Twitch. They were doomed, but they lived in the agony of will. As Hugh Miller, once Attorney General under Willie Stark and much later Jack Burden's friend, said to him when they were discussing the theory of the moral neutrality of history, "History is blind, but man is not." "It looks as though Hugh will get back into politics, and when he does, I'll be along to hold his coat. I've had some valuable experience in that line." So now I, Jack Burden, live in my father's house. In one sense, it's strange that I should be here, for the discovery of truth had one time robbed me of the past and had killed my father. But in the end, the truth gave the past back to me. So I live in the house which my father left me. With me is my wife, Ann Stanton, and the old man who was once married to my mother. When, a few months ago, I found him sick in the room above the Mexican restaurant, what could I do but bring him here? Does he think I'm his son? I can't be sure. Nor can I feel that it matters, for each of us is the son of a million fathers. He's very feeble. Now and then he has the strength to play a game of chess, as he used to play with his friend Montague Irwin, long ago, in the long room in the White House by the sea. He used to be a very good chess player, but now his attention wanders. Or on good days now he sits in the sunshine. He can read his Bible a little. He's not strong enough to write anymore, but occasionally he dictates something to me or Anne for a tract which he is writing. Yesterday he dictated this to me: "The creation of man, whom God in his foreknowledge knew doomed to sin, was the awful index of God's omnipotence. For it would have been a thing of trifling and contemptible ease for perfection to create mere perfection. To do so would, to speak truth, be not creation, but extension. Separateness is identity, and the only way for God to create, truly create, man, was to make him separate from God himself, and to be separate from God is to be sinful. The creation of evil is therefore the index of God's glory and his power. That had to be, so that the creation of good might be the index of man's glory and power. But by God's help, by his help and in his wisdom." He turned to me when he had spoken the last word, stared at me, and then said,
"Did you put that down?"
Yes, I replied.
Staring at me, he said with sudden violence,
It is true. I know it is true. Do you know it?
I nodded my head and said yes. I did so to keep his mind untroubled, but later I was not certain but that in my own way I did believe what he had said. He kept on looking at me after I'd spoken, then said quietly,
Since that thought came into my mind, my soul has been still. I've had it in my mind for 3 days. I've held it there, to be sure, by the test of my soul before I spoke it.
He will never finish the tract. His strength fails visibly from day to day. The doctor says he will not last the winter. By the time he's dead, I shall be ready to leave the house. For one thing, the house is heavily mortgaged. Judge Irwin's affairs at the time of his death were tangled, and in the end it developed that he was not rich, but poor. Once before, almost 25 years before, it had been heavily mortgaged. But then it had been saved by a crime. A good man had committed a crime to save it. I should not be too complacent because I am not prepared to commit a crime to save the house. Perhaps my unwillingness to commit a crime to save the house, assuming that I should have the opportunity, which is doubtful, is simply a way of saying that I do not love the house as much as Judge Irwin loved it, and a man's virtue may be but the defect of his desire, as his crime may be but a function of his virtue. Nor should I be complacent because I tried to make amends, in a way, for a crime which my father had committed. What little money did come to me from my father's estate should go, I thought, to Miss Littlepaw in her foul, fox-smelling room in Memphis. So I went to Memphis, but I found that she was dead. So I was denied that inexpensive satisfaction in virtue. I should have to get whatever satisfaction I was to get in a more expensive way. But I still had the money, and so I'm spending it to live on while I write the book I began years ago, The Life of Cass Mastern, whom once I could not understand, but whom, perhaps, I now may come to understand. I suppose that there's some humor in the fact that while I write about Cass Mastern, I live in the house of Judge Irwin and eat bread bought with his money. For Judge Irwin and Cass Mastern do not resemble each other very closely. If Judge Irwin resembles any Mastern, it's Gilbert, the granite-headed brother of Cass. But I don't find the humor in this situation very funny. The situation is too much like the world in which we live from birth to death, and the humor of it grows stale from repetition. Besides, Judge Irwin was my father, and he was good to me, and, in a way, he was a man, and I loved him. When the old man is dead and the book is finished, I shall let the First and Third National Bank take the house, and I don't care who lives here afterward, for from that day it will be nothing to me but a well-arranged pile of brick and lumber. Anne and I shall never live here again, not in the house or at the landing. She doesn't want to live here any more than I do. She's let her place go to the children's home she was interested in, and I imagine it will become a kind of sanatorium. She's not very complacent about having done that. With Adam dead, the place was not a joy but a torture to her, and the gift of the house was finally her gift to the ghost of Adam, a poor gift humbly offered, like the handful of wheat or a painted pot in the tomb, to comfort the ghost and send it on its way so that it would trouble the living no longer. So by the summer of this year, 1939, we shall have left Burden's Landing. We shall come back, no doubt, to walk down the row and watch young people on the tennis courts by the clump of mimosas, and walk down the beach by the bay, where the diving floats lift gently in the sun, and on out to the pine grove, where the needles thick on the ground will deaden the footfall, so that we shall move among trees as soundlessly as smoke. But that will be a long time from now, and soon now we shall go out of the house and go into the convulsion of the world, out of history, into history, and the awful responsibility of time.
The End. You've been listening to All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, narrated by Michael Emerson and directed by Greta Byram. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, narrated by Peter Francis James. When Invisible Man first appeared in 1952, it remained on bestseller lists for 16 weeks, won the National Book Award, and established Ralph Ellison as one of the pillars of 20th century American literature. Expelled from a southern black college for introducing a white trustee to some local color, a nameless young man moves to Harlem. There, he embarks on what will become a lifelong search for truth and a better life. Learning that his former headmaster's letters of recommendation are derogatory only adds to his growing sense of disillusionment. In his search for some degree of social visibility, he becomes a spokesman for a group of activists known as the Brotherhood. Unfortunately, their agenda proves more important to them than racial equality. Although this book chronicles a young black man's search for identity through a maze of American intolerance, it's much more than a story of racial prejudice. It speaks of each individual's search for justice and truth in an increasingly devious and complex world. We also recommend No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy, narrated by Tom Stecciotti. Hunting antelope in West Texas, Llewellyn Moss stumbles across 5 murdered men and $2 million in cash. Deciding to flee the scene, he keeps the money for himself, but the consequences of this decision begin to dog his every move. An urgent, harrowing story of the war our society could be said to be waging on itself, No Country for Old Men is at the same time an enduring meditation on the beliefs and hopes that inform people's decisions and shape their destinies. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call the toll-free number found on the back of this book. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse our catalog, place orders, hear about our latest releases, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.